Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Over for some of us if you sat through the three-hour movie, but we are just getting started here on Post-Show Recaps Theater. My name is Ariel, and I am joined by someone who is played by Parker Posey at certain parts of her life. It is Grace. Grace, what's up?
There's a character named Grace in this movie, Ariel. Played by Annie Ryan, like, not Parker Posey.
But it's like different. Like, I can't say Grace twice. It's not as good. I got to go with the Parker.
All right, I'll be Elaine, I guess.
In fairness, I had forgotten that.
Elaine goes out with a bang. So I guess
yes,
we can play Elaine.
She does.
This movie.
You know, standing seemingly, supposedly, at least before we saw, like, you know, somewhat standing on the shoulders of Ari Aster? I'm not sure how to say it. I meant to look that up, actually. One of those, Ari Aster, you know, famous for directing Hereditary and Midsommar. And this movie, which is
third movie. Yeah.
Very different. But we had a lot of expectations going in, I think. Certainly I did.
I had high expectations. I really love Midsommar. I watched Hereditary afterwards. I think I've told you this before that I, you know, horror was not a thing I seeked out a lot. And until we were doing this podcast, and there's some horror movie that's like, oh, that's pretty good. And so I went back, and when I saw Midsommar, I went back and watched Hereditary. Not that Midsommar isn't a horror movie, but the way it was, so it's like Florence Pugh, you know, Scandinavia, you know, cult, you know, whatever. And so I was very excited for Beau Is Afraid. I'm a big Joaquin Phoenix fan. I think he can just play like weird and absurd. And he often like goes to these very interesting directors. He's been in Paul Thomas Anderson stuff before, like he did Her, and he did what's the one? Is there one?
The Master. What?
Yeah, he did The Master. So I like Joaquin Phoenix a lot. I thought this was really interesting. I knew nothing about this movie going into it. I think I know everything about Ari Aster's mind now after I've seen this movie. I think he just, like, I don't know. There's a lot in this movie. It's a lot. This movie's a lot. It's 3 hours, and then also the content is a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot of a lot in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, it's like weird horror psychedelic Babylon. You know, like it's weird, just weird and trippy and weird. Very funny at times. I would say not super like scary. It's not super horror-y, although I don't think it's billed as a horror. It's a surrealist black tragicomedy drama film. Right. Is that the real thing? That's a lot of a lot.
Even just that description. You know, and speaking about all these movies kind of at once, like, I was trying to figure out, certainly once I had seen it, because from the outside I knew very little about Beau Is Afraid, which is a thing that I like to do. I think listeners will, you know, sometimes if I can see a movie miraculously without having seen the trailer, that's a win as far as I'm concerned. Now it's that subtle distinction of I don't mind watching trailers. I actually love watching trailers. It's just
if you get
so
lucky
rare.
And you don't see
it,
you're
it's
like,
just
oh,
so rare to get to see a movie without seeing the trailer that, like, in some ways that's a welcome challenge, even though I'm not like a person who's like, I don't want to see the trailer. That's a spoiler. It's more just, you know, it's a little bit more subtle. But like Hereditary, like you said, was very much a true horror film. I actually, very quick story about Hereditary. I went to see it with my friend, and there were some people who wouldn't stop talking, and then maybe like 15-20 minutes into the movie, the people came out from the theater and were like, y'all better be quiet and y'all better leave. And then the problem kids eventually did leave, and then they restarted the movie. It was kind of crazy.
Wow.
I've never been through something like that.
They did have to kick somebody out of my Beau Is Afraid. He was definitely on something. I don't know if he was but he just kept saying, is Joaquin okay? And he wouldn't stop, so they kicked him out.
Wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this was fairly early in the movie, I imagine.
You do not underestimate a polite Canadian audience, Ariel, who will not say a word until you could. And then here's where I get, this is why I'm so afraid of conflict, Ariel, because like I would love to be the person who gets up and goes and tells the attendant that the person needs to leave. But I'm so afraid that it'll be so obvious that I was the person who got up and told them to leave. I just need somebody. There was a couple like, hey, shh, but like that was it. And so like it probably was like an hour in before he was kicked out. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, in this case, a 3-hour movie.
And then they restarted the movie. It's still.
thankfully, they did not. In this case, that's at least, that's only really the first third of the movie gone. Yeah. Then Midsommar was a little bit more like, I don't know, yes, surreal. Yes, there were horror elements, but something more about like, trauma and
the horror is wrapped up in nice sunny Scandinavian we're at the Midsommar Harvest Festival, like the horror is much more like I think like sinister and hidden behind the veil of niceties, whereas
up
like
front it's a little bit more like unsettling, I guess I would say. And
where Hereditary is like, this is a horror movie.
Yeah, Hereditary is like horror and it's horrible and all these horrible things keep happening and also scream and fire and oh my god. So the reason I bring those up is because I was trying to figure out like now with the Beau is Afraid of it all with this movie, like what is the prevailing, like there seems to be at least if not like a theme, like a prevailing emotion or if like emotion is on a spectrum, like a piece of the spectrum that all these movies kind of like operate in or under for the most part. And this one I would say is like a lot of anxiety, a lot of surreality is something that I think is true of all of them. I wouldn't include that in as like kind of like the thesis of each one, but anxiety and like just I don't know, like the everyday now being weird. I think the anxiety is certainly the biggest one because it's basically like one big anxiety monster. I was talking to someone who made a comp like you did of like Babylon of like, yeah, some parts of the movie I really liked. And then it kind of quote unquote fell off the rails. But somebody I was talking to talked about Uncut Gems and how that's a like super, super anxiety inducing movie just like from the get, and it kind of never lets up. And this one, and I think in a different way, is never lets up either. And I think in the way it never lets up is like you trying to figure out what the hell is actually happening in the movie.
Well, I think all three of his movies do, if I'm not mistaken, like it's very like about like family, it does play a role, right? Because Hereditary is about the family. Absolutely. I think at the beginning of Midsommar, right, Francis character has a lot like her family, didn't her family die? Am I remembering that?
In Midsommar, yes, the very beginning. That's how it starts.
Her sister.
Spoilers.
Yeah, sorry. Wait, sorry.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
That's the setup for the movie.
Yes, that is literally that happens in the first.
She kills herself, but she accidentally kills her parents as well, right?
No, I think it's on purpose. She takes them out.
Oh, so. She has a so yeah, she's like dealing with like the loss of her family. And in this, it's like very much like Beau's personal anxieties, and there is a big piece that, you know, we'll get into in the spoiler section, but about his relationship with his family. So I think that there's a tracking theme there about like family and how people your family, like how all of that stuff manifests, your relationships with your families. The thing I thought was interesting about Beau is Afraid is like it is very surreal, and it's hard to tell, like it almost does feel like at times, like I thought it was very interestingly that like there's times where it feels very cartoonish, like a live action cartoon, if that makes any sense. And then times where you think it's like moving away from that, but then brings it right back. So yeah, I think that there's lots to dig into. I would agree that not everything in the movie worked for me, but most of it does. And it's also another example of a movie where I am happier. You know, I think in a lot of the ways people who really were connected to Babylon, it's like, I get what he's trying to do. I feel like I understand he's taking a really big swing in making this weird movie that for me, again, most of the time it works. And even when it doesn't work, I'm like, I get what he's doing. It just is not for me, you know? So I like it. I think it's a very interesting like third piece, essentially, I think the most amount of money he's got, I think this is a much bigger budget than either Hereditary or Midsommar, which, yeah, so both of those got about $9 to $10 million. And this movie, he got $35 million. Unfortunately, it does not seem like he made about $3 million on opening weekend. Can you guess which place he had in the on the box office charts this weekend, Ariel? Would you like to take a guess?
Like the placement?
The placement,
like,
yeah.
What did he, like, if he medaled or not? On the, did he podium or not?
Okay, I'll tell you, he absolutely fourth, did not podium.
Fifth place.
No.
Oh.
Give you one more guess.
Eighth place.
No, ninth place.
Wow.
It lost out to Renfield, The Pope's Exorcist, and Evil Dead Rise, which I do think there is a smidge of, there's a fair bit of horror gore stuff, and this one is a weird movie, and it feels like it gets like intellectual folks who really like that. That's what my screening really I think felt like. It was pretty full, but it was at kind of the theater that plays the like these type of movies, so
okay.
Yeah, but did not it's ninth overall. It is third if you take new releases, no, not great for Beau Is Afraid. So
yeah, it's not great. That's I was a little surprised for sure. I mean, it did come out, you know, in a little early in some theaters, but yeah, I think the people who really wanted, like, I saw a lot of sold out showings or like close to sold out showings. So I think like the people who were excited about it, the movie nerds, if you will, the movie heads, like the A24 heads, were like really, really looking forward to it. And I
Deadline
think
Deadline says they said that this is solid business to do basically 2.7 million. So I don't know. Maybe I have a misunderstanding of the.
It's solid. I mean, you know, it's not going to do.
It was only at 900 screens. Yeah.
MCU numbers, yeah, and the screen, the ratio for sure is if you run it through like the percentage of like how many screens were they showing it at versus you know how much money they made, I'm sure the percentages or whatever that figure might be a little bit more favorable compared to the others on that list. But I think you know, it seems like the people who wanted to see it saw it right away, and then kind of word of mouth, at least in my corner of the world/internet/whatever movie dumb, has been, you know, kind of fine at best overall. Like, there are people who really like it, there are people who don't like it at all. I think a movie like this is always going to be a little bit polarizing, but this one feels more polarizing than his first two movies, at least to me.
Definitely agree.
So
are we supposed to cover Evil Dead Rise? Because that movie made like $25 million this weekend.
I saw that movie yesterday.
I heard it's fun. I heard it's very gory.
The movie is fun. Yeah. Very gory. Kind of in the way that we talked about Renfield being gory.
Yeah.
You know, the Evil Dead franchise has always been very gory and kind of like winky and naughty at the camera kind of gory, and like a quote unquote fun way for people that enjoy that kind of gross stuff. There were a couple of times where I looked down at the screen.
Yeah,
I do this thing that I never do.
Yeah.
Which is I yelled. I was like, oh.
I'm an audible reactor, definitely to scenes.
I can be when it comes to stuff like that. When it comes to like gory or disgusting things, I kind of need to like get that energy out. And you know, I'm not going to do it in like a very quiet part. Usually, those parts of the movies.
Well, yeah, because every time you did it before, they restarted the movie.
I'm usually lucky, and those parts of the movies are very either loud or grotesque. Yeah. So other people are usually having a reaction as well. And it's us like, why is that guy keep exclaiming during this quiet part? I'm trying to remember what it was that was so gross. But anyway, that movie's gross, but it was a lot of fun. Evil Dead.
The thing for me is it's not playing anywhere like very close to me. So like it's like the thing of like, I could go see it, but then I have, and then
Evil Dead Toronto. Come on, let's go.
And I haven't really seen the other one. So it's like, I feel like I got to watch the other ones before I go and see it. So that's the dilemma.
I've seen enough of them. My brother was always a big fan of, you know, the Bruce Campbell and the Evil Dead series. So I saw a lot like quote unquote over his shoulder kind of thing. You know, I was like the little brother. So he was like always in control of the TV, but you don't have to see the other ones. I think there are like certainly winks and nods to like the originals, to like the
Sam Raimi movies. I'll check them out.
For the most part, it's just a good time, and there are two parts specifically that I wrote about on the Discord that like really, really made me laugh. But Beau Is Afraid. I was afraid that I was not going to like it because someone saw it that I knew and I looked at their Letterboxd review and I was like, ooh.
This is such a quick tangent. Did you see that I very briefly was like adamant that I wasn't going to rank movies and I wasn't going to rate them anymore. I was just going to say I liked them or I didn't like them.
Either a heart or no heart. Yeah.
But then I gave up and I was too sad that there was like inconsistencies. And at the end of the year, I couldn't go back and actually rank them. So I went back and ranked everything. I rated everything that I had seen and I chose I wasn't going to rate. But
hilarious, yeah. Grace. Yeah, I had noticed that you had switched over to that method and I was not going to even bring it up. I was not even going to give you.
Well, there's another movie podcast we talked about, like, why are we doing this immediately after we see the movie? We have to give it a rating. And it's like, I like that point, but then also it's so inconsistent that I have all of these ratings and I didn't have anything else. So, you know,
it's true. I think there's only been like one movie that I didn't rate. It was like kind of like a rewatch, but I think it's, I liked this person that I was speaking to again, and you now as well. Also, this comp to like Babylon, I think is a decent one insofar as it's so much movie and it's taken a lot of big swings and only some of them are landing. I think I do prefer Babylon a little bit more personally myself, but I was afraid. I read something. What was the thing that I read? Somebody's review that I agreed with. Oh, it was, I really want to see it again, but not for a really long time. I think it was somebody on the Discord. That's kind of how I feel about it.
I said this about a movie, another A24 movie showing up, which is that I thought that as the movie was going along, I was able to recalibrate. I wasn't liking it. And then I did like it because I realized that the sense of lostness, is that a real word?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was like, oh, I get that the feeling that I've been feeling has been intentional. So I was like, I like it and I'd love to rewatch it.
Right.
I don't really want to rewatch it anytime soon because I didn't really like it. So I do feel like there's the same, you know, very similar vibe here where I did really like most of what he's doing. And even if I didn't like it, which we'll get into some of the stuff that didn't work for me personally, I'm like, I get what he's going for. So like, I don't know, hard to complain. And I don't want him to stop making, I want him to make more movies because I find his movie making really intriguing. So yeah, this is also based off a short film called Bo, which I would love to try to track down at some point, but I don't know how readily available it is. Based off a short film. And then he decided to redo it during COVID.
I wonder if it's technically a short, but like it's an hour and a half.
That's right.
He made Bo's Afraid. Mm-hmm. He's like, we need to make it twice as long.
That's right. That's right.
But I agree. And, you know, we're always talking around here, you and I, about we love big swings, right? We're always going to ask for more swings. We're never going to say do less swings. Do, you know, make more boring expected stuff. That's
make your movie shorter. Yes.
Make your movie shorter. Yes. But compact the swings into a shorter mm-hmm. time frame, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is how art gets made, you know, and for some people that sounds, you know, sacrilege to the word art. But I think there are things in this movie that are so ridiculous and so over the top, but also so singular and so interesting, and certain things that we've never seen before. I just think it's always going to be a good time, even when it's 3 hours and there's some stuff in this movie. I was like, well, could you have cut that out? It's actually hard. You know, for the most part, I have a pretty, and listeners will know because I'm doing it all the time live on the pod, where it was like, you could have cut out 10 or 15 minutes. I can think of a few scenes. This one, you know, there's certainly in 3 hours you can find some stuff to trim, but I think it actually works really well in its intention, like you said, of like the whole time I'm on the edge of my seat and I kind of never lean back in my chair. I'm just leaned forward trying to like figure out what's happening. And I think that's certainly to the movie's credit because it's intentional. Oy. All right. I think we've danced around some non-spoilers enough. I think it's time to spill the PSRT. It's going to be 3 hours long. My summary, just warning
people. People will know that the runtime on the podcast is proving you to be a liar.
People will know. Bo is Afraid. We meet Bo Wasserman, played by Joaquin Phoenix, as we said, who lives alone in a crime-ridden city. His therapist prescribes him a medication that he can only take with water. While heading out for a plane trip to visit his mom, he sleeps through his alarm. This part was like so real and understood. I think as the movie goes on, it gets more and more ridiculous. But for now, this part was like, oh my God, the anxiety of just this specific thing is so relatable. Sleeps through his alarm because someone had been knocking on his door all night, telling him to turn the music down through these like very funny notes. He's not playing any music, to be clear. So it's like all very, it's just like the beginning of the surreal journey that he's going to go on. He hastily packs up his keys and the luggage is stolen from his front door. I think it's really his keys and keys specifically, right?
It's both. It's keys and his luggage.
Okay. Keys and luggage. Okay. He calls his mom. And he's letting her know that he can't come. And
he kind of asks her, like, very early on, they establish this relationship where he's like, what do you think I should do? Essentially, like, he's looking for her to say, you should not come. Essentially,
my anxiety is spiking. This is so real and just, and not even in parent and not only just in parent, child relationships, but in a lot of like friendships and just relationships in general, where you're like looking for the, you're in some way or another looking for permission to do the thing that you want to do, but you're not
so, like, we shouldn't cover Nightmare Alley, right? Like, we don't have to cover the movie Nightmare Alley. Like we don't, like we could, but we don't have to.
I really didn't want to cover.
Like, I mean, it gets nominated for Best Picture, but like, we don't, like, it's not like, you know, like, if we don't do it, like,
it's
just an internal conversation that I have on my iPad.
Dragging my feet so hard on that one. And to this day, I consider it a personal triumph that we never had to cover it. Because I am selfish. I'm a very selfish human. Okay. So, Bo, you know, she kind of dismisses him. She's not going to give him the okay not to come. So it kind of ends on like this weird, or she kind of does. But by the time she says don't come, it's kind of like, no. Now it's gone too far in the other direction. And I feel bad now, which is what he was trying to avoid. So he takes his medication to calm his anxiety, but he finds that the water has been turned off in his apartment. And that's bad because he has to take it with the water. He rushes across the street. Leaving the door open to the downstairs door to the building open with a phone book. But as he's in the store, everyone on the street enters his apartment. There's like this very weird confluence of things that happen where we're not really sure why certain people are running around in the building and seems like someone's getting hurt and not getting hurt. And it's very weird. In the morning, he calls his mom, but the phone is answered by a UPS driver.
Played by Bill Hader.
I couldn't tell. I know later on we see Bill Hader on the camera, but I didn't hear Bill Hader here.
I couldn't figure out who it was, but the then phone. I was like, ah, it's Bill Hader. Yeah.
Okay. The phone is answered by this UPS driver who is played by Bill Hader at some point, if probably here as well, just over the phone, who says that a chandelier fell on his mom's head and she's dead. It's this really horrible thing of like, I don't know, I just work here, or I'm just dropping off a package here.
He's like, there's this, it's so funny. He's like, could you hang up because it's probably wrong. You probably did not mean to call me. So why don't you hang up and call your mom back?
Call your mom.
Bo hangs up and calls his mom, and the guy just is like, oh shit.
He's face up and he's like, yeah, she's dead.
Yeah, chandelier fell on your mom, man. I'm so sorry.
It's very funny. I agree. So after Bo attempts to take a bath, but there's like an intruder literally hiding on the ceiling, kind of like suspending their body between two.
He's doing a survivor challenge.
The wall. He's doing a survivor challenge. That's right. From like from a very, very early season. After a brief confrontation with a police officer, Bo is hit by a truck. And that's not good, as most people know. Bo wakes up in Grace and Roger's house. Grace and Roger, played by Amy Ryan and Nathan Lane. They care for him along with a veteran named Jeeves, who served with their son, Nathan, who has passed away. So the couple's angry teenager, Tony, played by Kylie Rogers, automatically hates Bo. Bo calls his family attorney, Dr. Cohen, played by Richard Kind, who says that Bo needs to come home so they can bury his mother. So Roger, Nathan Lane, says that he'll drive Bo, but not until he is healed. This was like a weird part where I started to kind of like lose my sense of time in the movie. While in their home, Grace suggests that Bo is being watched, and he takes Bo, like, he even sees, she tells him to turn to like a specific channel, I think it is, and then he like sees himself on the TV almost as if he's, you know, in some kind of like psychiatric institution or something.
No, he actually he sees himself, like what he's going to do, and then
first he's just seeing like a live thing, then he goes backwards in time to see everything that happened before, and then he eventually gets the idea to fast forward and see stuff into the future, which is something, to be clear, I would never would have thought of, and in fact, even if I had thought of it, I would be afraid to do
it.
He
sees everything. He sees moments that we will then see throughout the movie.
Exactly, that he hasn't even lived yet, which is crazy. So Tony takes Bo into Nathan's room and tries to make him paint the room, but then she like has this crazy idea that she wants to drink the paint, and he won't do it with her, and she literally drinks the paint and dies. And I was genuinely shocked that this could happen. I know that sounds crazy, but I was like, what's gonna happen to her? Oh wow, she's just dead now.
Yeah, the painting of the room is because, like, so Bo sleeps in Tony's room, and Bo's like, so kind, he's like, I'll sleep on the couch, I don't mind. Mm-hmm. And she's like, no, whatever. She's like, but there is an empty room that's totally like available, but it's Nathan's room, and because he's died, they've like kept it like entirely intact as it was, with like memorials for Nathan and stuff, so they won't let him use the room. So Bo is sleeping in Tony's room while Tony is sleeping on the couch. So she's like, in a fit of rage, is like, in rebellion, is like, let's paint the room, which she does. She writes Bo on the wall, and then she drinks the paint and dies.
She writes Bo on the wall with in that same color paint. I'm trying to remember now.
Pink paint, but then she drinks the blue paint.
She drinks the blue green paint. Gross. Mm-hmm. And also just like super upsetting the way her eyes change. So where are we? Tony, Tony has not
Grace blames Bo.
Died. Grace, who was my co-host, blames Bo and chases him into the woods and sets Jeeves after him. See, I didn't remember that his name was Jeeves, so I just realized who the Jeeves character is, because it's very upsetting. Bo stumbles upon a traveling theater group, and I was reminded, this is Ariel talking, I was reminded of Station 11, theater group called The Orphans of the Forest. While watching one of their plays, he imagines himself in it. It's that thing where like they're starting to tell a story, and then it sounds very familiar. It sounds like his story that we've been watching, and then literally he kind of becomes a part of it. During the sequence,
this is a sentence I'm very excited for you to read, Ariel.
During the sequence, we learn that Bo's mom told him his father died when his father ejaculated and conceived Bo, a condition from which all Wasserman men suffer. This is a real thing that happens in this movie, because I remember it.
Yes.
And I was like, wow, that seems weird. When he walks out of the show, a man tells Bo that he is this aforementioned father, before being blown up by Jeeves, and Jeeves chases Bo. So Jeeves, who has been set to sick Bo by Grace, is now ostensibly killed Bo's father.
Yeah.
At least the person who said they were Bo's father. So Bo hitchhikes his way home and learns that he's just missed his mother's funeral, which this feels like a nightmare that I always have, where like I'm late to class or something. I'm late to something, and then by the time I get there, it's over. He sees Elaine, played by Parker Posey, a girl he met when he was young on a cruise he went on with his mom. And we've seen like glimpses of throughout the movie. And she had told him to wait for her, you know, wait for me, we'll meet again in life kind of thing. They have sex upstairs. Bo is terrified because, you know, he has been warned by his mother that if he, you know, orgasms, that he's probably going to die, at least based on his family's history. But, you know, he does the deed and he survives. It's crazy. And we're all surprised. But then we're a little less surprised because Elaine has died. Elaine played by Parker Posey. And I will just say, I'll just say it here because I'll probably forget to say it later. This actually makes sense to me, because the mother says to him, your father died on top of me. So the idea of like location became very important, because in this sequence, Elaine is on top of Bo. So I was like, oh, something about her being on top is the reason why she died. Whereas if Bo had been on top, maybe he would have died like his father and his father before him. That's my only theory.
My read is that there's a lot in the movie. So when he takes a bath before the man who's hovering above him falls on him. Mm-hmm. And then also Roger, when he's like, yeah, I cleaned up your stitches. Also, your testicles were huge. And there's a bunch of scenes of like just Joaquin Phoenix, like not prominently, like it's not like he's like naked and you see it, but like the implication is that he has ginormous testicles. Mm-hmm. And so my reading of the of what happened is that he had suppressed his doing masturbating or mm-hmm. having sex because he was worried that he would die so right. much that by the time the first time he does it, it was such a big uh-huh. that he just like Elaine caused her to like freeze and like be like frozen and dead. That's like my reading of the movie, I think.
Yeah, I mean that kind of makes sense. You could argue, as I sit here and just process this in real time, this ridiculous statement or this ridiculous thing that we're talking about. It would have made sense for me if the movie had said like he hasn't done this in ever ostensibly, that like that would actually lead to him being even more in danger and like killing himself faster. But you know, I think you could argue that
he's never done it. He's never messed
right.
because he's
all the more reason why doing it should kill him. But whatever, he wasn't.
He thinks he's gonna die. But no, then when he does, it's not true. I don't think what his mother told him, because we meet his father. So what he does, what he's actually done, is years and years of buildup, and then okay, I'm just gonna say it. And if you're deaf children, they turn off the podcast. He comes so hard, he kills her. That is my
that is
the
thing
movie.
That happens. That is certainly objectively true. Whether the why, you and I could sit true. Here and debate the why, we won't any longer. But yeah. It is true that what you just said is exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And I was devastated because I love Parker Posey.
I know.
So it's not how I wanted her to go out.
The scene, because you'll get to the reveal next of when she's moved out of the house, but it's Parker Posey has to like freeze naked in this one position, in the position she was in. Is that's some high quality work from Parker Posey.
Yes, they literally have to take her out of the room like a straight up mannequin. I guess she really is at this point. She has been mannequined.
Yeah. Is that how they make mannequins?
It has to be for all time. It will be for me now. From now on.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
So he survives miraculously. Mona appears. This is his mother.
His mom, yeah.
Played by Patti LuPone. Three people cheered in the theater. And I was
hell yeah,
those three people that know it's her. Reveals that she is alive. Oh, actually, one thing that I will call out too is Parker Posey's character right before they start to have sex plays
Mariah Carey, right?
Not Heartbreaker. Mariah Carey song Fantasy.
Yeah.
And from the first note, I knew exactly what song it was, and I cackled. And there were, again, only a few of us in the theater that realized, because as the song went on and more people realized what song it was, they laughed.
But Mariah Carey was went to the
premiere.
I know
Mariah.
Yeah.
And I was hysterical. Yes, and to what you're about to say, Mariah Carey was on the red carpet, and I saw a picture and thought, that's weird. Why is she there? But now we know.
Yeah. I don't know this woman, but I mean,
Patti LuPone, is this like Jennifer Lopez? Mona, aka Patti LuPone, appears. She reveals that she is alive and she's been watching Bo. This is not good. I mean, good for me in the sense of like, this is weird. She reveals that both therapists worked for her. This is horrible. And to prove it, they play tapes of sessions where Bo complains about his mother's treatment of him. This is brutal. This is like my worst nightmare.
Stephen McKinley Henderson, who is just delighting in being the bad guy revealed in the movie. Yes. He's so funny.
Bo demands to learn the truth about his father. He's taken into the attic where he sees a secret twin brother that he has. And also literally a giant penis monster. And I can attest to this because when I saw the outline of this thing, I was like, please don't tell me that's a... And the lights came on. I was like, yep, it's a giant penis monster. Jeeves attacks the penis monster.
Yeah. Yep.
But is stabbed in the head and killed.
Yeah.
Bo strangles his mother. He stops before he kills her, but she does pass out. Bo leaves and gets in a motorboat. He enters a cave and he finds himself in a weird stadium. This was giving me like, I don't know, a little bit of Truman Show at this point. Mm-hmm. This dome thing.
Yeah.
Dr. Cohen, his therapist, again, sitting with Mona, who is Bo's mother.
Dr. Cohen is the attorney, the family attorney.
Yes.
Richard Kind. Yeah.
Richard Kind. Yes. Dr. Cohen is trying to lay out the case for why Bo is a bad son. So it's kind of like we're in a court of law, but imagine a rowboat in the middle of water and then like a platform on top and people just kind of staring at him. It's pretty unsettling. This lawyer tries to, and then there's another lawyer, Bo, you know, even in pretend law courts of law in like a small puddle of water, thing of water. There, you are allowed to have a defense for yourself. So this lawyer who is defending Bo is very far away and you can't hear him. Like this feels very nightmarish in the way that like things, a lot of things this movie do really, like the way certain things move slow or like you can't get away from certain things fast enough or certain things are really far away. Like that nightmarish quality of like never fast enough or never, loud enough or clear enough or whatever. So this lawyer tries to argue Bo's case, but he's shoved off the platform. He dies. He's clearly this guy gets no respect. This lawyer, Bo then tries to defend himself, but finds he is stuck in the boat and the rattling motor catches on fire, exploding, turning the boat over. Bo drowns. And then the credits roll and the people slowly make their way out of the stadium as people in the theater slowly made their way out.
Well,
of the theater, they were kind of confused as to whether the movie was actually over or not.
Well, yeah, in terms of the credits, it's like they actually like for the people start to leave and then the credits come on and you realize like, yeah, that's the end of the movie. Like there's nothing more. You just kind of hear like Mona crying. And that's it. And so like, yeah, it's just like and it's like, all right, I guess that's the end of the movie. It's very interesting.
And if I'm remembering correctly, I remember like people murmuring. I don't mean in my audience. I believe like in the audience of the movie that is watching like Bo's fake trial.
Yeah.
They're kind of like murmuring as they walk out in a way that like people do in real life when they're walking out of a theater. I can't remember the last time I heard a theater be so quiet. And I mean my theater, like once the movie was over and the credits were rolling and people started to walk out, I can't remember feeling the silence so deeply.
So my feeling of the movie is that I talked about it like being very cartoonish. I feel like the crime ridden, like homeless city, like we have like a homeless man who's naked and stabbing people. And like all of this feels super cartoonish, but in a weird like Ari Aster way. And I really like it. I really think it's in terms of expressing like why Bo would be afraid. And then there's these subtle hints about his relationship with his mom. Like I think his mom tries to call him in therapy and then he does call his mom when he sleeps in and that whole conversation, it's really good. And as the movie's like progressing, as he's trying to get home, he sits in the, the orphan, the Orphans of the Forest thing. I'm pretty sure I would need to rewatch this, but there's like an old man who's like in the tree who is like the person who invented it. And I feel like when I didn't notice it the first time, but the time when he's running away and that guy, like Jeeves, is like shooting everybody, it looks like it's Joaquin Phoenix, who's like the old man who runs the Orphan.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know that for sure. But I feel like the movie is so surreal. And then at the end, we get this. The other reveal we haven't said is that in terms of how she fakes her own death, is that she pays off their maid who, or like nanny who helped raise Bo. And I did notice that the woman had like a weird, like an interesting birthmark on her hand. And that's how they reveal that like Bo actually knew when he has sex with Elaine that his mom wasn't dead, because he recognized the birthmark from his nanny, who you presume actually took care of him. So I love the like fake my own death. And then I feel like it gets super real in this like thing about Bo and his relationship with his mom, and she's playing these tapes that are like very reasonable things to hear in therapy, where it's like, she would do something for me and I would respond back, and she would feel like I didn't give her enough love. Like I didn't love her in the same way that she was loving me. And you could feel that when she's like yelling at Bo, and she's complaining about this whole thing, is that she sacrificed everything. And that she feels like, and it's this like very toxic relationship that Mona has with Bo that affected Bo. And I think that like, even the stuff that doesn't totally work for me, like the fact that like the Parker Posey scene where he like finally has sex and he has not mastered and like kills her, like even that stuff, you can through the lens of like so much of the actions that he takes are to like try to figure out his relationship with his mom. And like he's clearly been told this thing. You know, it's about his fears and anxieties. Like, he's afraid if he has sex, he will die. So he does not have sex. That's a lie his mother tells him to basically assert control over her son. I like everything we get up to the point where she's like, do you want to see your father? And it's the penis monster. The penis monster does not work for me at all. like 0% of the penis monster works for me, because I feel like there's this... Like, and I get that he's trying to do, Ari Aster is doing this on purpose. And again, I'm not like faulting that this, the choice he made doesn't work for me. I feel like there's like all the absurdity of the first like 2 hours, 2.5 hours of the movie culminate in like, I feel like this scene that has so much like realness baked into it, like real relationships people have with their mothers or their parents or people that they're close to. And like the way that those, like if you're, and you're dealing with like a toxic person who's like your mother, which is so unfair. And then it like hits absurd again. And I actually like the trial. I guess I just don't like the penis monster. I guess, because how does it exist? But whatever. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, the thing with the penis monster for me specifically was it didn't feel, while I do think that it does feel like a little bit of like, okay, now we've gone and done that. Like, it feels like a little bit more of a leap forward as far as like, we're going to do something super crazy that's kind of not explainable. It didn't feel so much, it didn't feel that far out of the box for what the movie had already done, just as far as like something, I don't know, maybe unexpected.
What's the most like absurd thing that's like not realistic to have happened thus far up to that point in the movie? Right,
the thing with Parker Posey, right? Like the thing with had that happened already? The thing where like he orgasms
he kills her.
Yeah, that he kills her.
Yes, I mean his giant testicles, I guess too.
Yes,
so, again, these are all wrapped up in this. Those. These are kind of all wrapped up in the same thing, you know.
Yeah, no, that's true. Certainly in the same area. But I think there was something about it that felt very. This is going to sound so crazy, but there's something about the penis monster that actually feels very simple, like in the sense of like there isn't some grand psychological explanation. It's like, here is literally this like giant penis monster, and that kind of would explain a lot of these terrible things, just because that in and of itself is that ridiculous. I think it's so much of the movie. I had said this before the spoiler. You know, when before jumping into spoilers, but I can speak a little bit more clearly about it now. Like, so much from the very beginning of the movie, basically, I'm trying to figure out not just what's happening and like keep track of what's happening, but what is actually real. I think there's the very genuine, literal read of a lot of the things that we're saying, which we see happen on screen, right? Like the giant penis monster, for instance, or, you know, the paint thing, the play, that he feels like he's part of the play. There's this part where he's kind of like in this weird like storybook animation thing where they're trying to like tell the story about how he's looking for his kids that he never even had. All of that stuff, like, I'm kind of latching onto and trying to figure out what's a metaphor, what's real, what is he actually doing, what is he actually experiencing versus what is being presented that he may or may not be experiencing that could then later be you know, kind of explained away. I think it's the most impressive thing about the movie for me is that for 3 hours I was wondering what the hell is actually going on, and I never really got truly frustrated. There were frustrating moments, but I never like I never completely disengaged from the movie for that reason. Like, I never said, oh god, this is too confusing, or this is too, I'm having too much trouble understanding what's actually going on. The movie kept me entertained and kept me like interested enough in the plot, even though, again, sometimes you kind of have no idea what's going on. So I just think I'm mentioning that because I think there's just like overall quality to the movie of like, in the end, you see all these things happen as we presented them literally in our plot summary, but you could still go back and be like, okay, what actually happened? Like, what is the movie actually about? And two, what is real, quote unquote? What did he actually experience? And more importantly, I think for me anyway, what if at all does that matter? Like, what is the supposed difference between what we saw and what he actually experienced? Is that even the point? Because some people would say no. Part of me would say no.
In my opinion on that idea is that everything other than him in the play is really happens to him. I think the question that I'm interested in terms of like when I rewatch this movie is how much does his mom set up that he experiences, and how much is it actually the world? So the person who shoves the paper under his door, who keeps saying turn down the music, and it's almost like everybody in this area is like homeless and like crime. There's all these people. There's a guy who just keeps like chasing, but he's like heavily tattooed and he just keeps chasing Bo every time he sees him in the street, right? Bo has to like run back to his apartment. But so you can kind of think like all these people have mental health concerns. So this guy putting the paper under Bo's door that says turn down the music, and then he's like, later he's like, I ask you to turn down the music and you turn it up, like how dare you? While seemingly somebody else is like, I think nobody is playing music until this guy gets fed up with Bo playing music and then plays his own music. That's my reading of all of that happening. So when Bo wakes up and he's late, it's like somebody actually playing music.
Right.
Is that something that there's only a few scenes that like Richard Kind's character, the attorney, is like pointing. There's like the scene when Roger asks, it's okay if I take you tomorrow, right? And Bo never really answers. He like freezes up and Roger like lingers on him for a while and then goes, okay, great. But Nathan Lane can just like, hey, bud, or is it dude? My dude. He kept saying my dude. Uh-huh. So funny. But how much of this stuff is stuff that, because we know that he's being watched and Mona, like the big Jumbotron comes down and they're playing stuff. At what point are we supposed to think that from the very beginning, is the paper under the door actually a test for, but like, do you love me enough that somebody disrupting your night's sleep enough to like, but you'll still wake up on time? Like, we don't get an answer to that, I don't think, but I think it's in the world in which I actually think when I say the world is cartoonish, I think that's the world we actually, that Bo is afraid is set in. And in that world, Mona is rich enough that she can like have cameras and set up all this stuff and watch Bo and like keep an act and set up this whole thing where she's going to. And once he sleeps in and is just, you know, I lost my keys, like losing your keys, are you still going to like come and visit me? Like, oh, nope. Like you're not. So like, I'm going to kill myself and then we'll really see how much you love me. I'm going to pay the nanny, her family enough money that they'll never have to work a day in their life. Like that's the test. So for me, I think like it's surreal, but I think it's real for Bo in the sense that he lives through it, except for the fantasy of the play. I think that the play is his.
And even that, I think you can argue in this like, I'm trying to think of another word, but in this reality, right, that you're saying about like everything that happened to him actually kind of did happen. Mm-hmm. There's a world in which he kind of did experience it that way, even in the play, right? Like he got up and then it, he had like a delusion or he had an hallucination or whatever, and then it kind of subsided and then he kept being chased. So like even that part of it, I think, is fascinating to consider now under this like umbrella that you're that you have opened for us.
So in that story, the tale is that he finds he keeps walking until he finds a village, he finds a wife, and he has three beautiful boys. Hilariously, they're like all the same age. Like it's like they never explain that. And then that whole story keeps going and going where like they get separated during a flood, and then he finds his way back to them during watching the play. But then they ask him like, well, if you've never had sex, how are we your children? And it like snaps him out of the thing, and his father's there to be like, hey, Bo, like I think, you know, I saw your father. Bo never learns that guy is his father. We never like, there's no confirmation that guy's his father either. That guy just says like, I saw you, I knew you as a boy, and Bo projects that it's his father. So that to me is like, that's my reading of the thing, is that basically everything that happens for the most part is set up by Mona.
Mm-hmm.
And Bo really lives through it. Yeah.
He does. And so did we. And, you know, we have to call out. I did watch it with someone who was like, I know that woman is famous, but I don't know who she is.
Patti LuPone?
When Patti LuPone showed up, it was very funny. And I think for sure, Patti LuPone having so much fun. She's giving so many great monologues and like lines and some ridiculous scenes to act out. I think probably rises for me, the thing that rises to the top immediately is when she has to fall through the glass table. It just felt so, I don't know, almost campy in this way where I was like, yes, Patti, fall through the table. I'm so happy for you. Just like as an actor, even while I don't understand some of the things that are happening on the screen. But I think ultimately the movie, if someone said to me part of what the movie's point is like analyzing, you know, certainly not just a parent-child relationship, but like a mother-child relationship, in this case, a mother-son specifically relationship, and the perils of that, the emotional trauma and just devastation that a relationship like that can have on you and your life, like that, I think for sure is super compelling. And the fact that they got Patti LuPone again to be that actor, I think just lends much more credence to that, to that being like really the one of the theses of the movie, if not like the ultimate one. It's fascinating to me, but I think it's ultimately, I kind of love that if you were to ask someone like what the movie's about, in some ways it kind of doesn't matter, because as part of the movie says, it's the journey, right? Not the destination. Don't forget what you're about to say, but certainly for me, it was more about the journey, because once we get to the destination, I was pretty quiet. Like some of those audience members where I was like, is he dead? Was there like a monster down there? The way you actually had to explain to me off pod that the engine explodes, because that's something that I didn't really catch, because to me it felt like there was some kind of entity or monster under the water that had flipped him over. And
another dick monster.
I know, right? Like now it can swim.
Yeah.
But you know, we see some like storybook elements from earlier in the play. I was like, maybe there is like a monster. That's like, and then the movie ended. That was the most surprising thing too to me, of like, I'm thinking the movie's gonna has like maybe 15 or 20 more minutes to go, and then it just ends. I was like, oh crap, I guess it's the end.
There's a scene where when he's about to have sex with Elaine, and I turned to who I went with, which is Alex, who's a PSR Discord a patron and a friend of mine, and I said, is he about to die? And I said, I think so. And I said, good thing the movie's only about half over. 2.5 hours in. There's a great interview on Entertainment Weekly from Clark Collis, who was assigned a beat, which is, can you explain the ending of Bo is Afraid? So we interviewed Ari Aster. He said, so this is Clark. Ari, what's going on with the giant penis monster living in Mona's attic? Ari Aster says, I don't know. His dad's a dick. They ask a little bit about how he got made. He says, I've been asked to write an article explaining the end of Bo is Afraid. Ari says, you have to explain it? Clark says, yes. What should one say about the end of Bo is Afraid? Ari says, I don't know. What are you going to say? Clark says, well, I was hoping to quote you on the subject. Ari says, oh, but I made it. It's there. Clark says, right, let's try a different approach here. What do you hope people feel about the end? Ari says, God, I don't know. I tried to do it in such a way that there's a number of ways you could feel, right? I'm not trying to dictate a feeling. I don't know. I don't know. It's yours to do what you like with at this point. I have no idea. that's the ending of Beau's Afraid, according to Ari Aster. I don't know.
Nailed it. So,
for me, I think that the way I can give the most generous read to the penis monster, because it's my biggest hangup in the movie, is that that's not actually Beau's dad, but Mona is such a toxic, mother that she creates a giant penis monster to convince Beau that that is his father. That is my cartoon world read that she in a tube. She made a little she has so much money. She's immensely wealthy. She just makes a giant penis monster. Speaking of her wealth, one of my favorite lines of the movie is Parker Posey comes in. Elaine is like, "Sorry, I'm late. I thought it was at 8. I think she said, I thought it was at 8 p.m.
I thought it was at 8 p.m., not 8 a.m. So she shows up 12 hours.
Yeah. And then she goes, and she owes me money, but we could probably, you're not probably not the person to deal with that. It's so funny.
Parker Posey is, when I saw Parker Posey show up, I was elated. Like the movie definitely hit like another gear for me in that moment because I was like, oh my God, is this now the adult version of that little girl that he met on the cruise, which is then like, basically all but confirmed because of like, you know, some things that they say to each other and they kiss and all that. It made it, I don't even know how to explain it. It made it more real. Like it made it feel more real to these points that we're talking about of like what was real and what wasn't real. This thing of like this person coming back felt so real world in a way that a lot of these other things kind of didn't. And I'm such a Parker Posey fan. So again, just seeing her do great work and get to die an incredibly epic death that no one will probably ever forget it's a wonderful moment for her personally. And I do agree with, I think the thing that you said about the origin of the monster kind of makes sense and just speaks to, again, the how central the relationship with his mother is and how she can affect as like, you know, if you carry the metaphor as like a lot of mothers can affect your read and interpretation of reality, right? Like that's, I think that's a fairly, at least emotionally, that's a fairly universal and understandable thing.
Yes. If somebody else can be like, no, his dad's a giant dick and that's what happened. But like, I don't think I'm there. I don't think I'm in with the, his dad is a dick monster. So I think I'm going to have to say that's also a lie his mother tells him.
Yeah. Well, what are these? Right. And like, ultimately what is a lie and what's true and how much does that even matter when like you've been, you know, in this case, like lied to your whole life by your mother. It's fascinating. I think there's a lot to dig into, certainly probably on like a second viewing, maybe in a year for me, maybe
3 hours long, you know,
maybe so, in 2027.
Yeah.
I don't know. How long will it be for you, Grace?
Probably, honestly, like, you know, a little while. Or the other thing that will happen is like Ari Aster, like we'll have another movie coming out and I'll be like, oh, I should rewatch all of this stuff. And I'll rewatch Beau's Afraid as part of that. I think probably. I mean, I really liked it. I thought it was really funny. I thought the writing was like very, very funny at times. I do like surreal comedy. The sex stuff is like not my jam. And it can be for other people. I'm just a little bit of a prude in that way. And I don't mean to say like, you know, it shouldn't be in there. It can be in there if it worked for people, and that's what Ari Aster wanted to do with this movie. It's just like that's one of the things that I often find like I'm not a huge fan of that comedy. But the rest of the movie worked really. I like Nathan Lane as like you know, Dr. Fancy, like that, who like kind of like had a son who died and clearly does not want, like, wants that son to have lived, and he hates his daughter.
Uh-huh.
Very funny, I thought. Like there's a lot of stuff in the with like Jeeves in the background of scenes like freaking out, and they're like tranquilizing him and giving him medications. Like they're awful people but are also like helping people, you know. It's like, I don't know, it's really funny.
I was pleasantly surprised at how many laughs there were. I mean, I think for me, in my memory, if I'm thinking back to that 3 hour time in my life when I was watching this movie, I want to say that a lot of the laughs came in the first half for me. And I don't mean that to say that there were no laughs, but there was like a little bit more of a steady ratio or level that I think as the movie gets a little bit more unwieldy, lessens a little bit. But I think it still has, as evidenced by the giant penis monster, still has like a sense of humor, a very pointed one. Excuse the word.
Yeah.
Yeah, very as usual, like a lot of just everyday, like in a movie so ridiculous, there's a lot of like everyday anxiety and everyday comedy. Like when I'm thinking of the moment in the store where I think he's like, he has money to pay for the thing, but he's, I think, like 2 pennies short or something like that. And then there's like all
first
this pressure.
His card gets declined. Which I think like, this is, yeah.
Everyone is like waiting for him to like pay, and it feels like everyone.
Going into his apartment. So he's like, I need to pay this, but like it's 2 cents, man. But also, like, they're all, I need to go save my apartment, essentially.
Yeah, right.
Those are the scene, I mean, in a really like, you know, critique on Mutt is like when he runs towards the policeman, and the policeman is like, I don't want to shoot you. And he's like, I'm holding my hands up. Like, please don't shoot me. Like, don't make me do this, man. You don't want to make me shoot you. And he's like, I am holding my hands in the air. I am being still.
Forgot about this.
Yeah. He's completely naked, and there is like a homeless.
Yes.
Like,
okay. Probably the thing that I'm trying to remember if I had a harder laugh. One of my two hardest laughs in the movie was this naked homeless man's name. The one that you were just alluding to.
Yes.
His name is Birthday Boy Stab Man.
Birthday Boy Stab Man.
Which felt like something out of like BoJack Horseman or just something so ridiculous. Because then in the credits, I cackled again because it's just Birthday Boy Stab Man.
Yeah.
Not great because, you know, there's a very gory part with this Birthday Boy Stab Man literally stabs Bo.
Yeah.
Very bloody, but this old man is very naked, so there's just something inherently ridiculous about the whole prospect.
Yeah.
Birthday Boy Stab Man, you'll always live in my heart.
Birthday Boy Stab Man. Up there with Scarface Yawns. When we get that category in the Emmys of best named character, Birthday Boy Stab Man will be up there.
But at least Birthday Boy Stab Man had something to do in this movie, unlike Scarface.
True.
Or a little bit more, at least, you could argue. Yeah, but what a movie. Bo is afraid. He's ultimately very afraid. I'm afraid that we didn't talk about something. Is there anything? Oh my God, wait. Haley Squires, who played Penelope, who I'm not remembering who that is now, but we know her as playing Sarah on the show Great Expectations that you and I covered.
Sarah the sister?
Haley Squires, who's an actress, plays Sarah the sister on Great Expectations. Pip's sister, Sarah.
Oh, yes.
And she was in this movie. And I remember thinking, I can't remember what part it was, but I remember looking at her and saying, I know this woman from somewhere, and I don't think I like her. To be clear, not the actress herself, but the character.
Who does she play?
I don't know. It says Penelope, but I don't know who that is. I can't remember. There are a lot of people in this movie, Grace.
I don't remember a Penelope in this.
There's Strange Man. There's a person on IMDb just called Strange Man who's in this. There's also a woman, Catherine Berube, excuse me the mispronunciation, Hero Bo's wife. So there's just a lot of like rant.
Oh, Penelope is the pregnant lady from the theater troupe, right?
Sure.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think Penelope is who he finds in the woods, and she's pregnant and takes him back to the troop, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But okay. Shout out Patti LuPone, and shout out certainly Amy Ryan, who when I heard her name was Grace, I was like, ooh, and then clearly I forgot because I just forgot.
She's very funny. She's very funny. Yeah.
She's the best. Amy Ryan is underrated as far as I'm concerned.
Agreed. Yeah.
Wow. Bo's Afraid. Anything else, Grace?
No, for Bo's Afraid, it's a lot. It's a lot of movie.
This movie's a lot. And a lot of people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we did too a little bit, right? I think
I liked it. I liked it. Yeah.
Sometimes I worry we talk and talk and it's like, what emotion was I feeling? Did that even come across? But you know, the pod speaks for itself, literally, because it's an audio medium. Grace, that's Bo's Afraid. What else have you got going on? Where can people find you?
Yeah, it's a big week for Succession coverage for me, as we did the immediate recap with Jess and Mike Bloom. I'll be doing the deep dive with Dr. Amanda and Lindsay Wilson, and then I'm going to chat with Rob about the Succession episode on the Rob and Josh show featuring Grace this week. Also chatting Yellow Jackets. We are doing a dark rewatch pod. You and I finished up our coverage of Great Expectations. And of course, more movies. I'm on Twitter at @HiFromGrace. What about you, Ariel?
Oh yeah, Great Expectations. I'm still recovering from that being over.
It was good.
It was good. It was only six episodes. It was shorter. Oh, no, I forgot. I was about to say they were six 30-minute episodes. They were shorter than this movie, but they were not. Oh. They were all in mostly an hour.
Yeah.
But still worth your time. What else? Yeah, Dark, like you said, covering Dark with DM Philly. And covering Grey's Anatomy once a month with Chappelle. And that's his own House of Horrors. Similar and also very different from this movie. Grace, we got anything coming up that's noteworthy?
Yeah, we're going to chat about Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, next week, which I'm very excited about. We should have a guest. I'm worried in case schedules change, but we will look to have a guest for that. Next week.
We're going to have Margaret on. Are you there, Margaret? It's time to get on the pod.
We're going to have God on the pod. Yeah.
Are you there, Margaret? It's me, God. But until then, stay tuned for that for sure. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Ariel. That's Grace. We are Puerto Rico Theater. Bye.